Back with you on a Tuesday, October the 25th, 2022 on Connecticut Today. 2 weeks out from the elections, we welcome State Democratic Party Chairwoman Nancy DiNardo on to talk about those upcoming statewide and local contests. And Discovery Institute Senior Fellow Dr. Robert Marbot chatted with us about the nation's ongoing homeless and poverty problems that we can't seem to beat. Joining us right now is the chairwoman of the State Democratic Party in Connecticut, Nancy DiNardo, is on the line. Hey, Nancy, good afternoon. It's Paul. How are you?
Good, Paul. How are you?
I'm good.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you. Nancy, that noise I heard over the past couple of days, was that you high-fiving everybody in Democratic headquarters with these poll numbers? Were you turning cartwheels or what?
Yes, I could have been, but I heard you earlier about polls and how people say, oh, you shouldn't really look at polls.
Yeah.
And I disagree. I understand, you know, it depends upon the margin of error.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the TNH one had like 2 point something margin of error,
yeah,
which I thought was really good because usually they say it should be 3 or less. But,
sure.
But it depends upon the questions in the poll that makes a difference. I don't look at, like when it says Lamont is up by 11 or up by 15 or anything, that's obviously what plays to the press. But what is important in the polls is the other questions that you may ask. And I used to, when I was town chair in my town, we used to do polls. And the questions you ask are what makes the difference in the election. For example, you might ask, what are your candidate's 3 strong points and what are their weaknesses, and the other person's strong points and weaknesses. And from that, you can develop your lit pieces. But I think what's also important in polls is they often ask, how do you get your information?
Yeah.
You get it from newspapers, TV, radio, and that is also important in how you develop your strategy going forward. So while I agree that the numbers like 11% or 15% are nice to see, you don't put any stock in it because it's, like you also said, it depends upon who comes out to vote. So you want to be working on targeting your people and making sure they come out to vote.
So, Nancy, as it sits today here on this October 25th, 2 weeks out, do you believe this could, at least at the top for Governor Lamont and Mr. Stefanowski, do you think this could possibly end up being double digits, or does your gut say, we got to act like it's single digits?
Well, of course, we run like it's single digits, but I think based upon what the governor has done in the 4 years he's been there and the untruths and issues that Stefanowski raises that people see through, I think definitely it could be in the double digits.
And we continue with Nancy DiNardo making her first visit to the program. She is the chairwoman of the State Democratic Party, longtime person in Democratic politics in the state. You know, Nancy, and you can imagine doing a show like this. I mean, I have no social life, and I sit and read politics stuff morning, noon, and night. It looks, Nancy, like the abortion issue may be running out of gas a little bit in other parts of the country. In fact, James Carville was quite vocal about that a couple of weeks ago. But the numbers here tell me that if abortion is the number 3 topic here in the state or the number 3 important issue, it looks like that's not the case here in Connecticut. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it might not be one of the top ones, but I have to tell you, women are very much aware of it, and while it might not show in any polls, it is on women's minds. And, you know, after 50 years of being able to choose and discuss it with their doctors, it's now taken away in other states, not in Connecticut. And I think that may be, you know, part of the issue, too, because people see that it's fine in Connecticut, and they think that can't change. But, in fact, it can change if Republicans win control of the legislature. And since nationally Republicans are against abortion, who's to say that the law won't change in Connecticut? So it is important that we continue to elect Democrats at the state level, at state legislature, as well as in the country. But that may be one of the reasons why people don't see it as much of an issue.
do you believe Bob Stefanowski and his running mate, Laura Devlin, who was voted this way in the state legislature, that they are pro-choice and would have no intention of going into that issue? Do you believe them when they say that, yes or no?
No. And because Stefanowski hasn't really said that. I mean, he has said that he would want to change it, that girls 16 or under have to notify their parents. And quite honestly, Paul, girls 16 or under who haven't notified their parents, and I don't know what the statistics are on it, but it's often because it's a case of incest. It's not necessary, or possibly rape, and they're afraid to go to their parents. But some do. I don't know what the numbers are as far as the ones that don't, but I know there are cases where they do go to their parents. So if you're saying, well, it's okay except for that piece, how do you know that there's not other pieces that he's going to challenge, but he's afraid to say it publicly because he might lose the few votes that he has?
Nancy DiNardo is the guest, the chairwoman of the State Democratic Party. You know, Nancy, I was talking about this when Mr. Lamont's taxes were released on Friday. And look, in the 30 years I've been doing these shows, I never, like my Italian mother used to say, it's none of your business what anybody makes. She used to tell me that, wagging her finger in my face. Never mind when I said, how much does somebody make, Mom? Never mind, it's none of your business. So, sounds like you've been there too. So, you know, Ned Lamont made 50-something million last year. Bob Stefanowski made his money. So this allows them to run, and I get that. But, boy, Nancy, you and I go way back to the days where you had to raise a lot of money to run. And you look at the actual fundraising numbers that we see from both parties, from Mr. Lamont and from the governor, Mr. Stefanowski. It's hardly anything. What are your thoughts on that? And is it keeping good candidates away who just may say, hey, I've got some really good ideas, but he or she on either side of the aisle, they're going to blow me away with money?
No, I don't think so. I mean, yeah, it's nice that they make that kind of money and they don't have to reach out to people, you know, for money to help run their elections. But in Connecticut, we also have that citizen election program for the underticket. And I have to tell you, I have heard, you know, from Democrats and Republicans, it's the best thing that we could have put into place so that people don't have to think about money up until the election. They have the timeline, and then they get, you know, their money. They have to raise a certain amount, obviously, and it's, I think it's now 200 or 250 maximum that a person can give. And so they don't have to think about that. Both Lamont and Stefanowski are fortunate that they don't have to think about it at all. But I don't think it's, you know, they've been, particularly Ned has been forthcoming about it. We had a kind of pull it out of Stefanowski to see where he got his money, and he finally relented, and still a little gray area. But I don't think people have a problem with it, particularly that they have to pick between two. You know, that's their choice primarily, is both of them have money. So I don't see it as a major issue.
You talked about choice, Nancy, and I say this all the time. I think negatively in some races, I think the tenor of our politics on both sides of the aisle, Nancy, has degraded a bit over the past 10, 15, 20 years maybe, where people are just locked into whatever the uniform says, you know, the D or the R, the Democrat or the Republican. And then I look back, and I'm a little bit of a student of history, and I look back at Connecticut's races with Jody Rell and John Rowland, and even back decades ago, and even on the national scene. What do we got to do to fix the tenor of our politics where we have people that automatically won't vote for a Democrat or automatically won't vote for a Republican? Because you've been around enough. What do you think?
Oh, I don't know how you actually change that specifically. But the thing is, we have, I think, over or close to a million people who are unaffiliated voters who make the difference in the race. Yes, Democrats have over 800,000, and I think Republicans, registered voters, over 400,000. And there are people within the Democrats and Republicans who say they would never vote for a Republican or they'll never vote for a Democrat. But, I mean, even the percentage of people who are voting, even though those numbers are very high, I think you're going to get about 60% of people coming out to vote in a gubernatorial. The highest, obviously, is a presidential, and the lowest, which I find so ironic, is a municipal. I mean, you're lucky if you get 40% in a municipal race.
Yeah.
And that's where you know the people. So, but I think that, you know, it really depends upon, even when I say this, you know, it depends upon what the message is that they're giving out. But even with that, I don't know how we could change people who are registered Democrats or registered Republicans on how they might vote for the other party. Of course, unless you're kind of weaving into the talk about ranked choice voting.
What do you think of that? Because I know that's a, I mean, and I've had guests on that on both sides of the aisle. It's the greatest thing ever, or it's a scam. And a few people in the middle. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, right now I think only Maine has it for their federal elections. New York has it, I think, for local elections. And I really haven't seen a lot on it. It's only, you know, this past year that I really have been hearing about it and paying attention to it. I know, you know, it'd be, change is always difficult for people, and particularly people voting, that, you know, are they going to know how to do it? It's going to be very difficult, and it might even discourage people from voting, you know, if they don't know how they're supposed to vote. But then there's always the other side where, you know, you're not just voting for one person, you're going down and voting for two or three or however many. I guess the state has to limit how many.
Yeah.
Or if they even do limit it. I think it's an interesting concept, but I don't really know enough about it to say, oh, yeah, that's great. And I, quite honestly, I would imagine it will affect the parties
interesting.
By having that. So.
Yeah. Nancy, final question. Governor Ned Lamont, you know, he came in 4 years ago following, I think we can all admit it, a guy who wasn't the most gracious guy in the room. He kind of prided himself on being, you know, referred to as a porcupine. And he's among other words. But, you know, his tutelage is interesting because he didn't bow or buckle to either side's extremities in messaging. He was kind of a hall monitor on both sides here. Do you think that has something to do with the fact that, you know, outside of his Senate run earlier, and I think a local position in Greenwich, this was a first-time thing to him? Has that helped him?
Well, yes, I do think it has. But I do want to say, I mean, when he ran in 2006 for the Senate, he said right up front, I'm running because I felt somebody should run against Joe Lieberman because of his position on the war, and I couldn't get anybody else. And if I said that, I felt I had to do it if I couldn't get anybody else. And then, you know, he comes up with this, well, this wasn't the first run for it, but for governor. But when, you know, he has come into it, I have to say, and I've said this over and over, that Ned really isn't a politician. He's a businessman, and I think that's what's made the difference for him. He meets with people on both sides, anybody, in fact, not just Democrats or Republicans, but he meets with Democrats and Republicans as well as anybody else and wants to hear what they have to say, and he weighs it when he is making any decisions. And I think that's why he has been so successful in turning the state around. That's true. You know, when he first came in, we were in a deficit, which we had been in for many years under both administrations. And now we have the highest surplus the state has ever had. And because of that, he has been able to reduce taxes for people, car taxes, gas tax. The one I like is that he eliminated the income tax on pensions and annuities for seniors. I wonder why I like that one. But
shocking.
And he's brought businesses back to the state. And he used to say, you know, when he first was going around the state, he used to see cars going out where people were leaving the state and businesses were leaving. Well, that's all turned around. I mean, granted, COVID has made a difference in also getting people to come to Connecticut, but businesses have been coming too. And speaking of COVID, I mean, we are one of the best states in handling it. And again, it was because Ned talked to the other governors in the area and listened to other people, and he was open to suggestions, and that made a difference. So I think he's done a great job. I mean, we're amongst the best states to live in, I think the fourth best state to live in, and amongst the top 10 for health care, education, and crime and corrections, reducing crime and corrections, and sure. I think it's, and it's also amongst the top 10 as far as raising a family, so, and Ned gets all the credit for that, because he's done a great job.
Nancy DiNardo, chair of the Connecticut State Democratic Party. Nancy, thanks for dropping by, for giving us the time. We appreciate it. You got the number. Don't be a stranger. And okay. We'll talk down the road. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye. Bye-bye. Homelessness and poverty. Yeah, you don't have to go too far, even here in uber-rich Connecticut. I mean, Fairfield County, New London County, some of the richest areas of the country, in the world, rich neighborhoods. But you have a homeless problem, a wealth and poverty problem, and we've had that for decades now, 50, 60 years in the state after urban renewal, and we still have these pockets and battles of poverty. What are we doing right? What are we doing wrong? What's the country doing right and wrong? Our next guest is a renowned expert on homelessness, senior fellow of Discovery Institute's Center on Wealth and Policy. He has a doctorate in political behavior and American political institutions. His career has been marked by bipartisanship, serving as chief of staff for former San Antonio Mayor Henry Cisneros while a House fellow under former President George H. W. Bush. Robert Marbot is the guest. Hey, Robert, it's Paul here on WICC. Good afternoon.
Paul, thanks for having us. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Talk about the Discovery Institute first, Robert, before we get to the nitty-gritty of this. What is that organization all about, and how did you become affiliated with them?
It's a national think tank, and what makes them pretty unusual compared to the traditional think tanks that are located in Washington, D.C., is they're located, of all places, in Seattle, even though they're national. And the theory was they wanted to be near real people and not the sort of inside the beltway type. So they're a little different than your traditional think tank.
Yeah, I to me, that's a big plus starting off here. You know, Robert, in Seattle, in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, here in Connecticut, in some of the most uber-rich areas of the country, they are connected to some of the most poverty-stricken areas of the country because there is some degree of homelessness and poverty, Robert. And we don't, is it just me? You tell me if I'm completely off base here. But is that like trying to grab into and grab a fish in a barrel here? Are we constantly missing the mark here? Why do we have this constant and in some areas growing homeless problem?
Well, I think it's very important to look back a little bit in history. If you just go back 20 years from 2000 to about 2011, 2012, 2013, homelessness in the United States was either dropping or flat throughout the country. There was really no place where it was actually escalating. And as a country as a whole, it had been going down for about 7 years, a little bit, not a lot, but a little bit every year. And candidly, that'd be great. But then the federal government in 2013 fundamentally changed how they addressed homelessness. And now homelessness is at a rate that we're probably going to be doubling now every 7 years unless something dramatically changes. So bad policy can actually make things worse.
So specifically, Robert, if you can just outline it for us, what did the feds do to stifle this kind of small, as you say, but gradual dropping and turn it around to cause this spike? What happened?
Pre-2013, every time a housing voucher was given away in the world of homelessness, let's just focus on that barrel as you were talking about, you had treatment and service requirements tied to it. Some of it was required. It was funded. It was scored. We looked for self-sufficiency. Then in 2013, and literally it's one document that came right out of HUD, it was like turning a light switch off. And it literally said, no longer is the HUD going to fund mental health, behavioral health, or job training. We are only going to cannibalize all our service money, put it into more rents, and we're going to move the money over. And so we stopped treatment, we stopped recovery, and not only did we stop it, the federal government came along and said that a local agency cannot require participation requirements. So that'd be the equivalent of having a Pell Grant for education and saying you don't have to go to school, you don't have to make the 2-0, you don't have to finish in 3 years. You just keep getting it unlimited. And in other parts of the government, whether it's Pell Grants, unemployment insurance, TANF, if people remember back to Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton, mm-hmm. they sure. got together and did some reforms. And
yes.
it's not perfect, but it's very much improved. But when it comes to homelessness, we've forgotten all those lessons.
And it's amazing, Robert Marbot, because people who listen to this show, and we talk about it all the time, and I'm sure this must drive you nuts, you have people generally on the left side of the political spectrum, and that's fine, and even some on the right who say, well, we have to increase services. So many of the people who are homeless, they're there through no fault of their own. They are drug addicted. They are alcoholic, tragically. They need recovery services. So I guess by what you're telling me in my audience, we kind of had that at one time.
We did, and it was going down. And what we're saying is we got to bring that back. We have to, and we're very careful. We're not asking for more money. We are very careful. We want to say, before you even ask for one penny more, let's make sure what we're spending our money on is doing the right thing. Because it used to be working pretty well. And we knew from the welfare reform stuff that Gingrich and Clinton did, that worked much better. Not perfectly, but much, much better. So let's do that before we start asking for more money. And let's spend what we're currently spending correctly. And we know how to do that. But what happened was the far left and sort of a movement that's called the, some of it thinks of it as a civil right, civil liberty, sort of mm-hmm. you have a constitutional right
sure.
to housing.
Yeah.
And then the harm reduction. And so those two movements sort of got together on homeless and said, these folks are victims, so therefore you can't require anything from people. You can't do this. You can't do that. And to me, that's actually not dignifying. That's not helping a person to enable a person to stay in homelessness rather than engaging and, mm-hmm. and customizing the treatment. And as you mentioned, substance abuse and mental health, those two together is about 75% of our problem on the street. And so why in the world would we not provide mental health services and substance use disorder services? And
Yeah,
we're saying go do harm reduction. Go now. You have parts of the country where the government all but funds your ability to do your drug habit.
Yeah, Robert, and I know you served under George H.W. Bush, but something George W. Bush, his son, used to say, and you probably heard him say this, when we have attitudes like that, it's kind of like, I remember him saying he called a lot of this stuff soft bigotry. Like, well, let's, you can't expect too much from, wink, wink, those people. And I would hazard to say that if you give them more services, you may, I don't want to say forcibly, but you do what you can to get them off the street and stop this being some sort of a rah-rah political issue, they might be a lot happier. I don't know. I'm no expert, but that's just me.
And I've worked with countries all across the, or cities all across the country, and there's sort of a new movement, which is exactly what you just said, which is we want to help the people who want to be helped. And we will do everything we can to help you because it's good for you, it's the right thing to do, and it's good for society because you move a person from being on the tax-subsidized rolls to being a taxpayer. And not having all these things. So, and we're already spending tons of money. We have to remember we're spending mm-hmm. money in the emergency room, the jails, the prisons, the criminal justice system, just to name a few, let alone the quality of life in a downtown, a neighborhood, et cetera. So we're spending the money. Let's start spending it correctly in a way that deals with the root cause rather than just give away a voucher with no rules, no regulations. It just makes no sense.
Talking poverty and homelessness with Robert Marbot from the Discovery Institute. He's a senior fellow at the Institute's Center on Wealth and Poverty with us for a few more minutes. You know, hey, Robert, excuse me, because I'm the cynical stooge they pay to talk here 4 hours a day from 2 to 6, but the cynic in me, Robert, and you've been around the block a few times, I think you know this far better than I do, you know, the cynic in me says, well, you know, whenever we solve a problem, Robert, some people lose a job or they lose a voice. I mean, I would hope, in all seriousness now, I'm not being funny here, I would hope that, you know, the notion of remaining just popular with people is not causing an unnecessary dependence here. I think you know what I mean.
And I think there's, you know, and maybe a cynic doesn't even have to be a cynic to think that. But for example, the first day I was in office, when I was the homelessness czar, that's the term the federal government uses back to Ronald Reagan. And the first day I was on the job, I got sworn in on like 5 o'clock. The very next day, 8 a.m., I met with 58 agencies that are all on, you know, mostly on K Street. Oh. And they're literally lobbyists to keep the money going to a program called Housing First or Harm Reduction or both.
How did your head not blow up like the first day on the job?
Well, I said I want to go in and get real results, and they looked at me like, well, we do provide real results. And I'm like, I don't think so. Homelessness in America, HUD measures 5 types of homelessness. It's now at 1.2 million people.
Okay.
Department of Education measures 5 types of homelessness, and it's at 1.5 million. So we're now at 2.7 million people experiencing homelessness in the United States, and we're growing at a rate that approximately every 7 years we are going to double unless we make some radical changes. And the irony was we were doing okay under Clinton. We were doing okay under George W. Bush for 8 years, nice and steady reduction, not perfect, but nice and steady. And we were doing okay even the first 4 years of President Obama. And then the moment he gets his second term, we suddenly change everything. And we move toward what's called harm reduction. We move toward Housing First, which literally is just giveaway vouchers, no requirement, no retreatment required. You don't have to participate in a program. We're just going to give you all this free stuff, and nobody participates to try to get out of homelessness. That, to me, is the nuttiest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, and it goes back to, Robert, and I've done a lot of reading on this because I have no social life, so I read this stuff. I'm a wonk, and I read this stuff, and this is the kind of stuff that, right, was being launched at people 30, 40 years ago. You know, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, he was a crusader saying, hey, you got to do this from the bottom up, not the top down, and he got chewed up and spit out of the Nixon White House by fellow liberals. Yeah.
And you got to, honor the fact that President Nixon brought him in, and he brought in some other people and were really sort of thoughtful about it. But as you point out, they got eaten up by the far left.
So what are we going to do? What if you were advising, Robert, you're in a room with whomever the 2024 candidates may be, whether it's Kamala Harris, whether it's Gavin Newsom, whether it's Ron DeSantis, whether it's somebody else, you would say, okay, here's your main point on addressing this. Bipartisan, regardless of party, what would be the big point you would want to stress?
Probably 3 real quick things. We got to stop the old policy that's not working, which is called Housing First. Andy Barr, a congressman from Kentucky, a really smart, smart guy on this issue, he's proposed what's called Housing Plus, and we should pass that. And then we should make sure there are participation requirements, just like we do for a Pell Grant, unemployment insurance, or TANF. And if you're getting something from the government, there's an obligation of 40 hours a week doing something productive, whether that's job training, mental health services, treatment, recovery, helping the place, whatever. We should be having a requirement rather. I don't think it's dignifying just to give stuff away and say, stay there, be homeless, and we're going to enable your condition. I don't think that's dignifying at all.
Robert Marbut's been the guest. Check out his page and his pieces. Go to the Discovery Institute. That's discovery.org. He's a senior fellow at the Center on Wealth and Poverty at the Discovery Institute. Robert, this has been fascinating. Hopefully we can have you on in the future. Good luck, and thanks so much. Take care.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Robert Marbut, M-A-R, Amazon Mark, A-R-B-U-T, discovery.org.